So do any of you remember that old Virginia Slims advertising campaign that aimed at selling cigarettes to women? Anyone remember it? What'd they say? What was the phrase? What? Thank you. You've come a long way, baby. The problem is, it's 2020. That was like 1967-ish, I think. And while we have come a long way, the very fact that women have never stood on equal footing with men, the fact that women have had to fight for a place at the table, or in the voting booth, or in the workplace, or in the pulpit, is a problem. And yes, we have come a long way. Unfortunately, we still have a ways to go. And I wonder why we had to come anyway. In the November issue of National Geographic, NPR's Michelle Norris writes, "When I headed off to college, my mother gave me a piece of folded up paper with a message she thought I would need. She wrote it longhand on a page torn from one of the little notebooks she kept by the phone. It said, 'No one can make you feel inferior without your consent.'" And it's a quote widely attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt. "It was a wonderful gift for a young woman setting off into the world." It's a quote to remind us that no one has the power to reach down inside your soul and turn down the dial on your self-confidence. I wish it was that easy to deny consent, to reach down into my soul and turn down my self-confidence. But as a woman living in what is still a man's world, despite the progress that we have made, I kind of am like that frog that gets put in a pot of tepid water. And the water keeps getting turned, or the fire keeps getting turned up and up and up until the frog finally boils. Which I did find out is a myth, by the way. But I thought it was an apt description of how I feel sometimes. Most days, I don't even realize how my own self-confidence is nicked each time I see a TV show or an advertisement with derogatory images of women. Or I walk away from a conversation thinking, "Oh, was I a little too assertive? Will I be thought of as aggressive? Was I not nice enough?" And my favorite is when I get asked, "Are you just hormonal right now?" None of your business. When you live in a world where you are constantly told, whether through conscious words and actions or simply by the way the workplace, the family, or the church is set up, that you are good and you are strong and you are intelligent and capable, but just not quite as good and strong and intelligent and capable as that man, you can start to believe it. And it is in the church where I have experienced the most sexism. In college, I was told by a male pastor and then by a female intern for women's ministries, that I could not be ordained, that it is strictly forbidden in the Bible that women to lead in the church. Unless, of course, the woman is teaching young children or other women. Right out of college, at a church sponsored marriage conference, I sat and I listened to a man tell a room full of newlyweds that husbands are to be the head of the household. And that as wives, we should submit to our husbands if we want to have a godly marriage. I stormed out of that hotel conference room straight to our 1981 Honda Accord, where I sat in that car and I cried tears of anger and frustration. My husband, a smart man, followed me to the car and said, "Let's get out of here." One time after preaching at a small church in Tennessee, I went to the back to shake hands, as you do, and this woman came up, and instead of offering up her hand, she offered up a critique. She said, "I couldn't even listen to you. You were wearing makeup and earrings." Still am. In one of my churches in New York, an elder currently serving on session came up to me, and in the hallway between the sanctuary and the parlor, they still call it the parlor there, and the parlor, he said to me, made a very inappropriate sexual comment to me, which would have been awful, but it was worse, because standing next to me was a 14-year-old girl about to be confirmed. He and I then had to head into a session meeting together. And I'll admit that when he said that to me, I remained silent. I didn't know what was happening, to be honest. I couldn't believe he could say something like that to me. I was in shock, and then I knew I was headed into a meeting with him. As I reflected, I became mortified that I didn't say something to him in front of her, that I didn't show him and her that it was wrong. Later, I did go to make a report about his comment, and when I went to make that report to the powers that be, I was told, "He's just a dirty old man. It's the way he always will be and always has been." And you can make a report, but there's probably going to be so much paperwork and so many meetings that it's just not worth it. But then I went to Bible study this week at this church. And I've got to tell you, I love that Wednesday Bible study group. This week we studied the book of Ruth. The whole book, all four chapters. And while I won't read for you all four of those chapters, the synopsis is, once there was a famine in Bethlehem. So a man named Elimelech and his wife Naomi, tired of starving, decided to take their two sons and go to the country of Moab, where they had heard there was plenty to eat. The boys grow up in Moab. They take Moabite wives. Ruth and Orpah are their names. But soon, Elimelech dies. And then shortly thereafter, the two sons also die, leaving Naomi and Orpah and Ruth as widows. All Naomi now has left are her daughters-in-law, and as much as she loves them, they cannot replace the husband and sons she once had. In the patriarchal culture of their day, women were nothing without their men. Literally, they had no rights, no security, nothing. So Naomi, seeing no other way, decides to pack up her stuff and go back to Bethlehem, her homeland, where she's heard there is now food and where she might have a distant male relative who can take her in and redeem her. Orpah makes the sensible decision and goes back to her mother's house in Moab. Ruth, however, begs to go with Naomi. It's where we find those words that are often taken out of context and put into a marriage ceremony, where Ruth declares her steadfast love to Naomi, "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Not even death can part me from you." Well, Naomi gives in, and they go to Bethlehem, and once they get there, there's really not much there for them. The two women have to live on the scraps that they're able to glean from the fields. That is, until Boaz takes notice in Ruth. He asks his workers in his field, "Who is that woman?" And when they tell him her story, he's impressed. And he makes sure she has what she needs for gleaning in his fields. When Ruth returns home to her mother-in-law, she reports that a man named Boaz has been remarkably generous to me. And Naomi, recognizing his name, immediately takes it as a sign from God that this is their window of opportunity. Quickly, she becomes matchmaker, devising a plan to get them together that would make anyone blush. But this was no time for modesty. In a very precarious position, the two women, they needed Boaz for safety and for security and redemption. Long story short, the plan works. And Boaz and Ruth end up getting married and having a son, which eventually ends up way generations longer later, Jesus. This can be a beautiful rags-to-riches story. It can be read as a risky romance or as a beautiful story of how love redeems individuals and families and whole communities. It can be read as a story that lifts up strong women in a Hebrew Testament where women are not usually seen as the center of the story. Or it can be a story about how foreigners have a place in God's story. This story is alive and has many compelling themes and voices. But back to Bible study this week. Toward the end of our time together, I thought we had all agreed that Ruth and Naomi were two resourceful women who understood the Jewish law so well that they were able to use that Jewish law to get what they needed. That they were brave and clever, and I was good with that. We had two strong female role models, and I could preach a sermon on that. But then, right as we were about to close up and go to lunch, a comment was made that went something like this. Yeah, great. So they were able to use the patriarchal law to their favor. And we lift them up as strong women for doing so, but why did they have to operate within a patriarchal system to begin with? Perhaps we shouldn't be simply lifting up women who find success within a broken system, but perhaps we should focus on dismantling the system altogether. And if you were in Bible study on that day and you don't remember that exact comment, I did use some of my own words, but the gist is there. And the idea behind the comment has continued to haunt me all week. Every time I tried to write a different sermon, and I did, check your bulletins, the title for this sermon is so not what I'm preaching on this morning, but I had to come up with that on Tuesday. There are other sermons I could have preached. But the question that haunts me, especially as we are in a Holy Shift sermon series, is why is there a patriarchal system, culture, to begin with? And how do we begin to dismantle it so that my daughter's confidence dial never has to get turned down in that way? And I don't have an answer to the question of why is there a patriarchal culture, except to say that I don't think that God intended it to be that way. But as I was considering how we might dismantle the culture, the character that became most interesting to me was the man Boaz, a man of great wealth and power, a man who in the patriarchal culture of his time and ours could have easily gotten away with harassing Ruth. A young, impoverished, widowed, undocumented female immigrant who probably spoke and looked different from the other Israelites who surrounded her, Boaz, on the other hand, was a male. He was Jewish, living in his native land, a descendant of one of Israel's leading families and a powerful landowner. He had the power to abuse Ruth and get away with it. And in fact, the power difference between Boaz and Ruth was chilling. Or Boaz could have simply left her alone to chance, not caring and not wanting to ruffle anyone's feathers. He didn't want, maybe he could have left her alone, not wanting to intimidate or embarrass or worry the men in the field. He could have done that, but he didn't. When Boaz notices Ruth gleaning in his field, he says to her, "Now listen, don't go and glean in another field. Keep close to my young women. Stay here. I have ordered the young men not to bother you." When I was in sixth grade, the boys were relentless in teasing me, but David Schletsky was the worst. And I remember one afternoon, shortly before the dismissal bell rang, David was being particularly annoying and mean, but this time his target was my friend Catherine. And I don't remember what he said to her, just the crestfallen look on her face when he said it. I immediately jumped in to defend her, saying something rude back to him, which only served for him to turn onto me, and gathered all the boys to come with him. As the insults flew in my direction, I waited for my friend to come to my defense. But she didn't. She just let him insult me. And I've never forgotten that feeling. That feeling of being picked on while my friend was not willing or able to help. Boaz doesn't do that. Boaz creates space for Ruth. She is able to work in peace and in safety. He knows that she is vulnerable, and he tells the other men, "Do not bother her. Leave her alone." He protects her dignity. And this isn't just a one-time thing for Boaz. In chapter 3, we get to this really juicy part of the story in which Naomi, wanting security for Ruth, tells her, "Go to our kinsman Boaz, who will be winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. Wash and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to that threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." Just as an aside, I want to tell you that I was in eighth grade, I was cast as Naomi in our youth choir's rendition of Ruth, the musical. And let's just say that the events and the euphemisms of this chapter, what happens on the threshing floor, went way over my head. The fact that feet in the Old Testament does not always mean feet, I had no idea. Uncover his feet, Ruth. I wonder how Ruth felt about doing that. I wonder if she was like, "All right," or if she was terrified. What will happen if Boaz is offended that she came to him? What if he doesn't want her there? What if, perhaps even worse, he does want her there, and in the darkness, when no one else is looking, Boaz does whatever he wants to her? What if it all comes down to he said, she said? Ruth knows that nobody in Bethlehem will take her word over his. Nobody. Lately, I've been watching The Morning Show, which is not actually a morning show. It's a riff on the Today Show, on what happened to Matt Lauer on the Today Show. And in the first episode, Alex Levy, who's played by Jennifer Aniston, makes this announcement on air. Good morning, I'm bringing you some sad and upsetting news. While I don't know the details of the allegations, Mitch Kessler, my co-host and partner of 15 years, was fired today. Watching the broadcast at home, Mitch, who is played by Steve Carroll, howls, "She's throwing me under the bus!" And yet, it is clear in the show that the TV executives have known for years that Mitch was taking advantage of women. But none of them wanting to lose their job, they pretend not to believe the women that have come forward, or they simply brush the woman's story under the rug and give her a promotion to keep her quiet. Admittedly, this show is a bit of a soap opera. It's intense and dramatic, but if it didn't hit so close to home, to the very true stories that keep getting uncovered in workplaces and in churches and in families and in communities all over, I might find it a bit too much. But it's becoming all too familiar a story. Ruth, go to Boaz and uncover his feet. To uncover something is dangerous. And yet for Ruth and Naomi to be restored to community, something has to be uncovered. Uncovering something takes us way deeper than most of us want to go or to see. When something is uncovered, we are forced to look at our own nakedness, all we are, like it or not, and all that we have done, all that we have tried to cover up. And let's be clear, it's not just individuals who can be uncovered, but entire communities, churches, the people of God in all of our human collectivity. Ruth and Naomi's community needed some uncovering. Boaz on the threshing floor was just the designated representative. Look at how we treat women. I imagine the community saying, look at how Ruth and Naomi must enact this elaborate plan in order to simply be redeemed, to be considered worthy, to safely live. Is this how we want our community to be? To uncover something is a call to action. It is truth-telling and justice-enacting. And it starts when someone lifts up the corner of the community and shows us what is underneath. Shows us that we are really family and that we belong to each other and that it is time to claim one another. Ruth goes to the threshing floor and does as Naomi has instructed her. Eventually, Boaz rolls over and notices this woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He asks. She answers, I'm Ruth. And then Ruth, the young foreign widow, decides she isn't going to wait for Boaz to tell her what to do, like Naomi said to do. Instead, in a move of great risk, she says to Boaz, put your cloak over me, basically saying, let's be together under this blanket, not just tonight, but every night. Let's get married. Ruth proposes to Boaz, and Boaz says yes. In fact, he replies, heck, I'll do everything for you. I'll do whatever you ask. May you be blessed by the Lord, for you are a worthy woman. And in a culture where Ruth had no value, where she was not worthy of anything but maybe the scraps left over in the field, this is gospel for her and for Naomi. In the end of the story, Ruth and Boaz are blessed by the community. They marry, they have a child, a son, because it has to be a son. But they have a son who carries on the family name all the way to King David and then all the way to Jesus. Naomi gets to nurse this child, and they live happily ever after. Now, legally, Boaz was Ruth and Naomi's redeemer. By Jewish law, he is the one who restored them to community. But I think it was really God who was doing the redeeming. God doesn't intervene much in this story, nor does God play a major role, but the steadfast love of God is evident throughout the entire story. In the faithfulness of Ruth, in the cleverness of Naomi, and in the compassion of Boaz. And isn't that the way that we see God at work every day? Isn't it through the loving kindness of those in our communities, through the men who speak up and make sure that women in their lives are respected and honored, who create safe spaces and lift women up? Isn't it through the women who cheer each other on and support one another? Remember that quote attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt? Turns out she probably never said those exact words. In a response to a question about a perceived snub, however, she had this to say. A snub is the effort of a person who feels superior to make someone else feel inferior. To do so, he has to find someone who can be made to feel inferior. Friends, people invested in the status quo will always be looking for people who can be made to feel inferior. So let's make it our job to make sure that it is no longer easy to find women and girls who can be made to feel inferior. Let's make sure that they know their power and their place as equals and as valued and as worthy women made in the image of and beloved by God. Amen.